Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com. Woodhill Community Center. Have a hand in the heart of the city. Support their mission with your donations at woodhillcommunitycenter.org. Toyota in Nicholasville Superstore. Online consultants are standing by right now to help you find your next Toyota. Visit Toyota on Nicholasville.com. Lexus of Lexington, home of the best-selling Lexus IS. Find yours today at LexusofLexington.com. Did you know that half of America is single? Hollywood has never produced anything like this before. The Dating Project, a groundbreaking documentary that follows five single people, ages 18 to 40, as they search for authentic and meaningful relationships. There is no script. There are no actors. These are real people trying to find love and happiness in an age of swiping left or right. From Empower Pictures, Paulus Productions, Family Theater Productions, and PureFlix, you can now own The Dating Project. Save the date by visiting thedatingprojectmovie.com and go a step further and help others in your circle date differently by partnering with Ascension Press. Visit shop.ascensionpress.com to acquire the companion study guide. The Dating Project Movie is now available on DVD and digital download on Amazon, iTunes, and Walmart. Please visit thedatingprojectmovie.com for details.
This is Setting the Record Straight with Chuck Coughlin. How you doing again?
Redboxmedia.com.
So what aspect of our life are we looking at today? I'm talking about ancient tribal religions. Religions that go back to thousands of years, or where we have preliterate societies. We don't know how recently they were invented. Maybe last year, 10,000 years ago, maybe 100,000 years ago. But what's particularly interesting to consider is how they are regarded today, because there's been a rebirth of interest in them. Anthropologists have always been interested in writing down the details of these religions. For instance, the remarkable records that the French Jesuits left in the Jesuit relations. They were great missionaries, intelligent and caring, and concerned for the people that they were evangelizing. Let's take in consideration what we do know for sure about the Indians around the Great Lakes in eastern Canada and the eastern United States, about the very detailed records about every aspect of the culture of the Indians in the Iroquois Confederacy and the Mi'kmaq Confederacy that the French Jesuits recorded in meticulous detail. One praiseworthy aspect of the Jesuits is their sensitivity to the native cultures. They always learned the language in as many details as they could about the habits and lives of these people before even beginning their evangelization efforts. When you read the Jesuit relations, you will see that they treated them not only with respect, but with very sincere love. How different this is than the popular misconceptions about these missionaries. I remember in my university days when I was studying the humanities, the course's content divided the Western European culture into three phases: classicism, romanticism, and realism. Of course, being 17, 18, and 19 years old, I was very taken with the romantic impulse. And of particular interest for this program is one of the aspects or characteristics that was listed for the romantic period in human history was a love of the exotic. And you will really find this to be true. One of the foundational concepts of the romantic movement is the idea of, quote, the noble savage, unquote. The noble savage views primitive man as existing in a more pure and innocent and virtuous state than modern civilized man. Well, this implies something rather obvious, that we'd improve ourselves by rejecting modern civilization, technology, and culture, including the center of the culture, the cult. Reject Christianity and return to a pure, more sinless, and noble and virtuous state. This is the idea of the noble savage. a return to a far more gentle way of life. So this was the concept of the noble savage, and many people succumbed to it. And any even lightweight examination of history or anthropology will quickly reveal that there's no truth in it at all. The noble savage is a myth, but it's a very persistent myth because it's so delightful. Just relax and everything will be fine. The noble savage contrasted with the depravity of the modern bishop. This kind of inverted thinking is very risky, and it's done a great deal of damage in the last part of the 20th century and the first decades of the 21st. But if someone is sufficiently intoxicated by wishful thinking, they may turn their eyes upon these cultures and see only the reflection of their own romantic imagination. If someone is ruthlessly objective, they could quickly discover the truth, could quickly find out that the whole thing was a fantasy, had no basis in reality. Its basis was in wishful thinking. But we're living in an age when a large number of people, perhaps even a majority, entertain this false conception as being true. And it has been combined with another impulse, the adolescent impulse to love chaos. The combined force of these two cultural impulses has resulted in a storm of chaos. The French have a rather delicious and accurate phrase that they use to describe this lust for the primitive. It's called nostalgia for the mud. Nostalgie de la boue, nostalgia for the mud. A desire, even a longing, to return to the primitive. And the cumulative effect, unfortunately, has been a decay and decomposition of a carefully and laboriously constructed great culture. Nostalgie de la boue is an attraction to the crude, to the primitive. It is obviously the most powerful impulse in our music, and few things are more mind-shaping than music. So the attraction to the primitive and to the crude and to a romantic false image of past primitive times became the most powerful current in our culture and shaped us. It was based upon a rejection of the wisdom of our parents and of our ancestors. It was an extension of the adolescent's rebellion, of all the valuable inheritance of his culture. It was an extension of the rebellious adolescent spirit into adulthood, into our adulthoods. And these perpetual adolescents took over the leadership positions in our society. We turned over the steering wheels of our society to a generation of 50-year-old adolescents. And the wreckage it produced in our culture is abundantly obvious to those with honest eyes. Yes, the very influential concept of the noble savage was originated in the 18th century by the famous French philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Rousseau has had great influence because of this concept and had a great revival in the 20th century in what is referred to as the culture of the 60s. The beatniks in the 50s originated it, but in the 60s and 70s it came to maturity in what is sometimes called a hippie culture. People who practiced that culture gave great interest and attention to alternatives to Christianity. And there were a lot of books that came out of that, like Conversations with God and The Law of Attraction. Some people call this New Age. It was sort of a syncretic movement, a sort of invent your own, like a cafeteria. Pick a little bit from this religion, a little bit from that religion. Or you could think of it as theological modules, like Tinker Toys. Let's combine this module from this religion with that module from that religion. That sounds pretty thrilling, doesn't it? Well, what's wrong with that idea? Well, if you're a divine being putting it together, you probably can design a religion that is based on wisdom about the truth, about a lack of self-interest in perceptions of reality. But if one's character is lacking in discipline, one will duct tape together certain modules of religion selected for self-indulgent reasons. That is composed only of the comfortable religious concepts and none of the uncomfortable religious concepts. You will construct a religion that is an intoxicating drug rather than a lens through which divine light reveals reality. Let me tell you how I'm using the term syncretic to describe this cultural phenomenon. Let's go to that great cultural monument, the Wikipedia, and see what it says about the syncretic or syncretism. Okay, here's the Wikipedia definition. Syncretism. is the combining of different, often seemingly contradictory beliefs, while melding practices of various schools of thought. Syncretism involves the merger and analogizing of several originally discrete traditions, especially in the theology and mythology of religion, thus asserting an underlying unity and allowing for an inclusive approach to other faiths. For lack of a better term, we can call it the New Age faith, though many might find that an objectionable term. It can vary quite a bit, but it has certain central features, which are often dogmatically and ardently asserted as being essential. One of these is reincarnation. Respect for the 10,000-year-old phenomenon called Hinduism, which is not so much an organized religion with easily integrated components as it is a gradual collection of a few thousand tribal religions. Underlying all this was an attempt to find a religion that didn't interfere with oneself, with one's desires, with one's bodily impulses, with one's desire for intoxication and free love. If there wasn't a religion already like that, one could simply construct it. That may not be what a syncretic religion always has to be, but in our time, that unfortunately is what syncretic religion has proved to be. So in the middle of the 20th century, there was a need for intellectual justification for these syncretic beliefs. It's a syncretic religion. And as I said, there's nothing intrinsically wrong with assembling found objects. But if it's done to seek only the pretty and the comfortable and avoid the reality that the world is a polar place with good and evil, light and darkness. If the criteria for selecting objects for assemblage into a religion is self-indulgence, then the resulting religion may produce cultural disaster. Since all things in a culture are downstream of religion, are most heavily influenced by it, then it may produce a disaster. We're presently witnessing a cultural disaster, partly for the reason of these found object religions. So let's return to our subject. Needing a new syncretic religion, those who should have not led us wrong led us wrong. There was a failure of intellectual honesty. So we had the fraudulent scientific studies of human sexual activity by Masters and Johnson and by Kinsey, and the bogus anthropology of Margaret Mead, such as Margaret Mead's very popular little volume, Coming of Age in Samoa, which was read by all undergraduates in the 50s and 60s, that depicted a mythical sexual promiscuity among young women in Samoa, wherein the young that they had that were illegitimates were raised by the whole village in a sort of indiscriminate motherhood. It turned out that these were invented stories. There was a great deal of that kind of thing that took a very noble science of anthropology and plunged this noble science into a new dark age, the new age of even greater superstition that we entered around the 60s and 70s and have not yet emerged from. So at the university, my professors were dividing the last few thousand years of history into classicism, romanticism, and realism, led us to believe that we were living in a realistic age. But what we were entering and are still in, is a deeper, darker romanticism, because it has a bright and beautiful side, and another side, which is a descent into ignorance, into darkness, and into superstition. The reason I refer to our own age as a darker age, because we know so much that's not true. We've richly furnished the rooms of our mind with a lot of concepts that have no basis in reality, and too often rejected our Catholic heritage or Christian heritage. And the result has been the decomposition of society, starting with the decomposition of the basic building block of society, the family. And it seems to be accelerating. Many observers think that religion is on the decline in our time, but that's wrong. What is on decline is many of the sects of the Judeo-Christian tradition in the churches and synagogue. And also on decline is the desiccated secularism, which is the late offspring of that tradition. Secularism is on a decline, too. But other, more ancient gods are alive and stirring. What is especially interesting, it is she that is on her way. She's stirring. The most ancient of all the great goddesses is on her way back. She was reborn some 30 years ago, appropriately enough, in the sunny hedonistic empire of California. Looking back over the last few decades, one can see more and more clearly how one movement after another served to undermine one of the key foundations of Christendom. And what it sought to undermine and replace was the intimate relationship of each individual human soul with their one God. By substituting a polyamorous, promiscuous sexual relationship of sexual beings with other sexual beings. The sexual revolution was the starting point of all the other revolutions, each one attempting to destroy the intimate bond between the Christian God and the individual Christian person. And of course, it began in 1960 with the introduction of the pill. The multicultural movement, rooted in the rediscovery of African and Asian experience, is in the process of dethroning the Eurocentrism of our culture. Scholarly feminists occupy the high chairs of academia, and they have been deconstructing what they see as the patriarchy, the egalitarian and anti-individualist impulses most recently coming together in the communitarian movement. Are putting in question the very notion of hierarchy on which all dominations rest, including the domination over the earth by the human race. People in this movement are envisioning not hierarchies, but circles to organize human groups. And they seem so eager to deceive themselves. And the rediscovery of the Native American worldview is really the discovery of fictitious accounts of what that was really like, such as the fraudulent books of Carlo Castaneda's. Perhaps the most famous one being the teaching of Don Juan, a Yankee way of knowledge, which represented itself as the true testimony of a real individual. But later it was realized that the book was fiction, and every word in it invented. But it was taken for being real, a real way to recover the ability of bilocation and other mystical experiences. It was fake, like so much of this movement. But we're hungry and credulous for a touch of the divine, and so many of us are seeking it. Everywhere but where it is. It would take some very powerful intellect that was our adversary to so mislead people. I wonder who's leading him to do that. In the new scheme of things, everything has rights. Communal rights. The rights of each individual organism are the same as the rights of any other organism. And so we come to the point. This is what the adherents of these nature cults believe, which is the revelation of Gaia. The entire earth is a living entity. There is no hierarchy. Every organism has equal rights to the human being. Along with this came a decision to blame something. What is to blame for all of this trouble that the world is in? This new movement and this new age decided who and what to blame. It is above all the Bible that must be blamed. It is no accident that this book begins with a creation story in which the first human, a male, needless to say, is given domination over the earth and all its non-human inhabitants. The aforementioned thinkers have demonstrated in one case study after another how the repressive, racist, phallocentric, and hierarchical heritage of biblical religion has deformed Western culture. The Christian churches, of course, have been the chief vehicle of this monumental deformation, they say. But one must go back much earlier to find the origins of the process. There is an event that discloses dramatically what the issue is here. The contest on Mount Carmel between the prophet Elijah and the royal chaplains of King Ahab. You'll find this in the first book of Kings, chapter 18. Elijah, faithful to the first commandment of the Sinaitic Code, challenged the legitimacies of Ahab's multicultural clergy, bested them in a competition of magic tricks. Who were these people with whom Elijah struggled? The biblical text describes them as, quote, the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table. That table in the palace of Ahab's queen was evidently an earlier vision of an interfaith convention. The Baalim, of course, were the agriculturally oriented divinities of Canaan, worshipped in sexually liberated fertility cults. And as Asherah was just one of the many names given to the great goddess of the Near East, identical with the Mesopotamian Ishtar. Ishtar, whom the Greeks called Alstart and identified with their own Aphrodite. Okay, let's translate this into modern terms. Elijah was struggling with a multi-diverse core of eco-theologians and committed feminists. In retrospect, we can only agree with him that the worldview represented by these people was incompatible with the monotheistic faith of Israel. Okay, let's put on our time transport boots and step back to Mount Carmel. Step back and reopen the contest. We stand here in the middle of a crowd that hopes Elijah will be defeated this time. For this time, her moment has come. And this time, it looks like she may be winning. The ludicrousness of these delusions becomes apparent when we begin to restore our unity with nature. As soon as we look carefully, nature is neither nurturant nor benign. She is immensely indifferent to suffering and immensely profligate in the expenditure of individual existences. So what is the message of these nature cults? Well, they're telling us that in our essence, we're not individuals. We're small and significant in parts of the vast pulsating whole of cosmic life. We become healed as we surrender our delusional individuality to this whole. It is not the individual as sacred, but the life process as a whole, Gaia, the living earth. And nothing matters beyond the endless thrusting of the divine energy. As we stand here, look up. You can see it. You can see the vision. Gaia has another face. It has been revealed most fully in India, in Indian sacred art. It is there given the name of Talig Durga, consort of Shiva, the goddess who both gives and destroys life. She manifests herself, her mouth gaping to show bloody fangs. In her four hands, she holds a noose, a skull-top staff, a sword, and a severed head. She's dancing on a mountain of corpses. Many people perhaps think they are not yet ready for this vision. But I assure you, it is the future to which she calls us, and is the future to which many of you have already embraced. Those of us cheering on Christianity, we must not only overcome the cult of nature. It seems at this time we must now overcome humanism also. Western notions about the autonomy and the rights of the individual derive in a straight line from biblical religion. During this program, we are reflecting on some common romantic illusions about some of the more primitive religions and the nature religions and the mother goddess religion. Nothing wrong with studying them for what they are, but let's be accurate and let's identify the romantic fantasies where they exist. We were talking about our desire to have nostalgia for the mud, a nostalgia for the primitive life, the fantasy about Tarzan and Jane, and the powerful tendency within our culture to sentimentalize in third world cultures. A great many people trace this intellectual era back to the noble savage, the concept of Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Now, Rousseau lived in the 1700s. A modern French writer, Pascal Bruckner, has written a very effective response to this concept of the noble savage. In the 80s, he published a book, The Tears of the White Man, Compassion as Contempt, Free Press, 1986. This valuable book did get a little attention from conservatives, but it was short-lived. Bruckner's book is a vigorous indictment of third-worldism, that species of romance that glorifies everything foreign, exotic, and primitive, while simultaneously railing against civilization, science, Christianity, and modernity. Well, the power of Bruckner's indictment helps to explain its neglect, because the message he brought was distinctly unwelcome music to the ears of politically correct intellectuals, whose smugness and sense of moral superiority then as now was inextricably bound up with the mendacities of third worldism and kindred specimens of emotional blackmail. Bruckner wrote that solidarity with oppressed people is above all a gigantic weapon aimed at the West, and this has made it a continuation of the Cold War by other means. Being European or American and being supported by a Western power is enough to make one suspect. What seems criminal in Cuba, Angola, and Guinea has the real purpose of washing away the far greater crime of colonialism. At least that's the way the argument goes. Now, Bruckner's message is full of meaning today as it was in the 80s, maybe more so, because today those attitudes are more thoroughly institutionalized, more thoroughly absorbed into established opinion. Well, first of all, who is this man, Pascal Bruckner? Well, he's somebody with firsthand knowledge of the problems he's written about. He worked as a member of the International Action Against Hunger. He animated compassion with deeds. If this tempered his romanticism, it also sharpened his vision. He did not rail against Western oppression. He did not curse the evils of colonialism. On the contrary, he understood that the West's real crime was not pursuing, but rather abandoning its responsibilities. And you could say those are the responsibilities of a colonial power. Or you could say that those are the responsibilities of a companion nation. Part of what makes The Tears of the White Man such an important book is Bruckner's sensitivity to the aerodynamics of liberal guilt. He understands what launches it, what keeps it aloft, and how we might lure it safely back to Earth. He understands that the entire phenomenon of third worldism is fueled by the moral ecstasy of overbred guilt. Bruckner is an articulate describer of such guilt. He points out that, quote, an overblown conscience is an empty conscience. Compassion ceases if there's nothing but compassion. You could call it soft pity. It's stimulated when guilt becomes a convenient substitute for action, where action is impossible. We resort to soft pity as a convenient substitute for not knowing what action to take. Without the power to do anything, sensitivity becomes our main aim. Our aim is not so much to do anything, it's to be judged. Salvation lies in the verdict that declares us to be wrong. In a way, this makes compassion trivial. It's not directed toward an individual because it's become universal. Roger Kimball has observed about this, that a sort of universal compassion becomes so thinly spread that it becomes trivial. This trivialization is one side of third worldism. Another side is the inversion of traditional moral and intellectual values. The West and Christendom once sought to bring enlightenment, literacy, civil society, modern technology, and the Christian religion to parts of the world that needed it and didn't have it. It did this in the name of progress and civilization and bringing souls to Christ that would have never known him otherwise. The ethic of third worldism dictates that yesterday's enlightenment be rebaptized as today's imperialistic oppression. Bruckner has said that for these third worldist people, that their great goal is not just the interchange of cultural influences, but in the recognition of the superiority of foreign thought, in the study of their doctrines, and in the conversion to their dogma. In other words, the recognition of the superiority of foreign thought. We talked about this earlier. Do you recognize an aspect of the love of the exotic that characterized the adolescent romantic? The third worlders fervently believe that we should take on our former subjects as our models. There's a long list of these objects of our adulation. The wisdom of the East, tribal Africa, Aboriginal Australia, pre-Columbian America. The message is the same. The absolute superiority of otherness, of the exotic. The third worldist looks to the Orient, to the tribal, to the primitive, not for what they really are, but for their evocative distance from the reality of modern Western society and values. It's all part of what Bruckner calls the enchanting music of departure. Boy, what a very French phrase that is, the enchanting music of departure. Its siren call is seductive, but it's also fraudulent. Indeed, the messy reality of the primitive world, its squalor and poverty, its penchant for cannibalism, slavery, gratuitous cruelty, and superstition, are carefully edited out of the picture. In its place, we find a species of the sentimentality of Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Rousseau is the patron saint of third worldism. Think of what he wrote. Here's what Rousseau wrote. Ignoring the real human race entirely, I imagine perfect beings with heavenly virtue and beauty, so sure in their friendship, so tender and faithful, that I never could find anyone like them in the real world. That's a quote from Rousseau's Confessions. The beings with whom Rousseau populated his fantasy life are exported to exotic lands by the third worldist, as Rousseau discovered the unreality of his scenario. Far from being an impediment to moral smugness, was an invaluable asset. It was an asset. Reality, after all, has a way of impinging upon fantasy, clipping its wings, limiting its exuberance. As Bruckner notes, and so the people who entertained this romantic vision were not looking for a real world, but the negation of their own. An eternal vision is projected on these nations that have nothing to do with their real history. The Australian anthropologist Roger Sandall does not mention the tears of the white man in his book, The Culture Cult. He goes farther than Bruckner in calling this romantic primitivism and designer tribalism. How's that for a marvelous phrase? Designer tribalism. What is designer tribalism? It is the unending revolt of the civilized against civilization. What Sandall describes as the culture cult dreams of a new simplicity, a mode of existence that is somehow less encumbered, less rent by conflicting obligation than life in a modern industrialized democracy. What a vain dream. The romancing of the primitive only emphasizes one's distance from its simplicities. Romanticism's in all its form is a retrospective phenomenon, like autumn. The more fervent it is, the more it underscores the loss it laments. Isn't life about ever-extending complexity? To deny that is to neglect the big ditch that separates the modern world from its primitive societies. On one side of the big ditch is the rule of law, near universal literacy, modern technology, and at least in some periods a fully realized Christianity, and the whole parade of liberal democratic largesse. And what is on the other side of the big ditch? Well, domestic repression, economic backwardness, endemic disease, and severe artistic constraints. If you want to live a full life and die in your bed, then civilization, not romantic ethnicity, designer tribalism, deserves your thoughtful vote. The culture cult is partly a brief for enlightenment values of universal culture and scientific rationality, and partly an attack of the various atavisms that Sandall sees impeding the growth of these values. So actually, the real target here is the assumption that culture is a value-neutral term and that one has to fight against ranking cultural differences in a hierarchy. In other words, we shouldn't make discriminations. They're all good, all equally good. One anthropologist, Claude Levi Strauss, famous one, there's no such thing as a savage mind as distinct from the civilized mind.
On Setting the Record Straight, this is Chuck Coughlin. Let us thank God for his gift to us of our glorious Catholic Church.
Introducing the redesigned CatholicSingles.com, featuring new ways that put the spotlight on the person and their faith, not just a profile picture. For the past 20 years, faithful Catholics have used CatholicSingles.com, and the reimagined CatholicSingles.com website is ready to help single Catholics take the next step in sharing meaningful relationships with other faithful Catholics. Remember, CatholicSingles.com for faith, fellowship, and love.